This is for the purpose of having a record on blackboard for those who might have missed a particular lecture. So to begin with, I'm going to spend the first portion talking about architectural theory and theories of urban design, because this is the period during which the first stage of Western urban design comes into its beginning maturity. And we'll see how that works in just a minute. But also, we're going to look at two, and I call it two and a half cities. It's actually one and a half plus one and a half, but they don't add up to three exactly. These are three examples of urban design that have had a particularly powerful influence on the development of Western cities. And as you can tell, though it lies rather a bit outside our range, a fine example of a Baroque city is none other than our own Washington, D.C. But first, I want to look a bit at a few items on the agenda that go all the way back to Roman times. So now, let's see. I have to load in. Give me a moment here. And where is it? So we're going to look at the way in which the Baroque city developed out of, first of all, the medieval city, which is essentially a fortress city. During the Renaissance, it becomes then a deliberately designed city according to certain criteria, not all of which, in fact, in some cases, none of which are particularly practical, but ideological. And then we move at the end of the 16th century, more or less, and into the 17th century, to the city as theater. And finally, at the end of our period, around 1750, and a bit afterwards, though it occurs already in the second half of the 17th century, we get the city as garden, where landscape theory and urban design merge. You'd be surprised how much impact this particular sort of movement, because it really is a movement of sorts, has had not only on the larger cities of the world, but even on the very small ones. All right, so to begin, I want to go back to Roman times, to the first century BC, which is the period during which we find a Roman architect and theorist by the name of Marcus Vitruvius Pollio. He was born somewhere in the decade between 80 and 70 BC. He ended up probably passing away sometime after 15 BC. So we think perhaps De Architectura Libri Decem, the 10 books on architecture, dates from perhaps around 20 BC, but it could be earlier, somewhere between probably about 33 and 20 BC was when it was written. This is a book that remained influential on Roman architecture later, but it was the first architectural work that really could be said to have included all of architecture. There were Greek treatises before, but they were very limited. This was a comprehensive attempt to give us an overview of architecture. And the 10 books then give us, among other things, a great deal of description of existing practice. That is to say, Roman practice, though it is true that Vitruvius uses some previous Greek practice as well as part of his sets of rules and designs for Roman building. He talks about streets, he talks about the orientation of a city, and the typical Roman city began, or at least the colonies began this way, with a crossroads. It was a later writer on the subject of the Roman city who pointed out that the, in fact, even Vitruvius himself says this, that the crossroads, if the roads are wide enough, turns into the forum, that is, the center of the city. When the Romans built a city, what they did was they established two roads at right angles, leading north and south, east and west. They had a very definite orientation, which, however, was determined by auspices, that is, by reading the livers of fowl and other creatures. So priests came out and read the, I suppose today, the feng shui, we would say, of the area. They did that, and they determined precisely how to orient the city. But they also worried about such things as the direction of the winds. They knew all sorts of things about how to site a city so that it would take maximum advantage of changes in the weather, so that you wouldn't have streets that were so located that the north winds would blow right down them. This is something we didn't learn when we built Chicago. Before Vitruvius, the Greeks built on, devised what we know now as the grid plan. So a good example would be Manhattan, or many an American town, and also the Spanish presidios in the New World. This is sometimes also called a checkerboard pattern. It's a highly rational way to build a city, and sometimes a little too rational, because the Greeks, who began this practice in Asia Minor, which was, of course, populated by a large number of Greek colonies, sometimes, however, they would adopt a grid where it wasn't particularly important. So it works very well on flat terrain. But when you go up and down hills, it doesn't work too well. An example of a city that goes up and down hills and that suffers as a result is our own dear San Francisco. But it can become a very rigid design. It's very useful because then you can have First Street, Second Street, Third Street, Fourth Street, and Avenue A, Avenue B, Avenue C. You never get lost. So, well, I'm at Avenue G and 42nd Street, so I know exactly where I am. That's the advantage of the grid. But the grid has to be imposed from the start. It's not altogether a rational matter. The grid was thought to be a replica of the cosmos. So the cross streets and the rest, we find this kind of design all over the world, even as far abroad as China. Besides the streets, there tends to be a wall around early cities. The wall is, of course, defensive. And as a matter of fact, in a number of languages, the word for city is exactly the same word as wall. This is true in Chinese, for instance. Our word city comes from the word for fortress, in fact, which we find in citadel. And in other languages, such as French, for example, cité, from which we get the word city, really means the central part of the city, the part that was once surrounded by a wall. Cities surrounded by walls sometimes take on a roughly circular pattern. And apart from the square, which represents the four corners of the globe and also the cosmos, we also get the circle, which is, of course, a perfect figure. And during the Renaissance, among other things, there were interesting attempts to create cities that were designed on the circular pattern, and also churches. There was a feeling that churches ought to be in the round. So this is not a 20th century innovation. it was a late medieval, early Renaissance innovation, and in fact, it goes back even earlier than that as far as Christian churches are concerned. Then finally, as we'll see, the Baroque city takes us to an interesting combination, ultimately, in Washington, D.C. Of course, that dates from the late 18th century as a design, and in execution, we have to wait for the early 19th century for building Washington, D.C. to begin, actually. All right, Vitruvius was rediscovered by an Italian humanist in the 15th century, and shortly after the manuscript of the Ten Books of Architecture was discovered, an Italian humanist, whom I'll talk about in a minute, and if you took the Renaissance world course, you've already met him, by the name of Leone Battista Alberti, wrote the first modern work on architecture. And in fact, it is a more thorough and more complete book on architecture than Vitruvius's was. The difference between them is rather interesting, but I'll get to that in a moment. In 1485, the Ten Books of Architecture was printed by none other a person than Aldus in Venice, and there were subsequent editions. Here is one that is corrected and dates from 1511, again published by the Aldine Press, so now some 26 years later. And Vitruvius was read and translated into languages all over Europe. Here is a German translation, Dutch Vitruvius, and here is an Italian translation from 1556, though not the first. And here is an 18th century Vitruvius Britannicus, a very important book in three volumes, that is a sort of compendium of building styles that were in vogue and recommended in England. So Vitruvius is a very important name. But by the 15th century, skipping ahead a great deal, we get to Leone Battista Alberti. He was a humanist. He was not at first an architect at all, an intellectual. And one wonders at this, how he could write an authoritative book on architecture. The manuscript he wrote over a period of about 10 years from 1442 to 1452, and there is a copy of the original manuscript in the Vatican Library. Well, there are several copies all over Italy because, of course, you know that just shortly after he finished it, Gutenberg invented printing in the 1450s, and it was published then in a Latin edition in 1485, the same year that Vitruvius was published. Now, this book had a tremendous impact on Italian architecture subsequently. But what's interesting about Alberti is, first of all, that he became advisor to the Pope. Now, the Pope in question is Nicholas V. And as you know, the popes had been resident in Avignon for a considerable time before they returned to Rome about a century, less than a century earlier than Nicholas V, who took up his papacy right at the time that Alberti finished up the book, which you can see alludes directly to Vitruvius, 10 books on architectural matters, I suppose, if you gave it a literal translation. But it's translated in the 18th century into English as The Architecture of Leone Battista Alberti in 10 books. Vitruvius had 10 books. Alberti had 10 books. Alberti says a number of very interesting things, not only about buildings, but also about the city. And in fact, it is the first modern treatise of any length on city planning. Alberti has all kinds of advice to offer, and this time around it's scientific advice, because Italian Catholics didn't take auspices, and even if they were descendants of Romans, they didn't cut open fowls and look at livers in order to figure out how to site their cities. Instead, what Alberti tells us is what kind of land to build on to avoid, among other things, malaria, how to site streets so that they're oblique to the main winds at any given season. He says a number of interesting things. On the one hand, he says a city is not unlike a landscape or a garden. So this starts early on in the mid-15th century. But he also says that a house is a city in little, or a city is a large house. And this, of course, continues the notion that in some sense or another, a city is a small cosmos, a small world of its own. And so the house and the city have a sort of macrocosm or microcosm-macrocosm relationship. Another thing that goes all the way back to Vitruvius, have you ever seen the picture of Vitruvian Man? You've seen it. It's a man standing like this, inscribed in a circle. This goes all the way back to Vitruvius, and he says that these are the ideal proportions of a building. The idea being that the human body is the measure for proportions, and therefore a building ought to be proportioned as a human body is. And so Alberti also turns to the idea that a building is a kind of body. By the way, this idea was revived in the 20th century by a number of architects who have looked back to the idea that in some sense a building ought to reflect the human body, because that's primarily what buildings are for. They're for human bodies, human comfort. The thing that Alberti does that is so important for us to understand subsequently is at the beginning of his De Re Edificatoria, he says that the architect is the greatest of all artists. Now, you have to understand that at this time, the architect was mostly a builder, a sort of contractor. Right, so not somebody that was held in high esteem. During the Renaissance, painters and sculptors were to liberate themselves from the trade and craft society and become recognized as on a par with poets and intellectuals. So by the time we get to Michelangelo in the 16th century, we have a painter, a sculptor. Michelangelo was also a poet. He was also a fine calligrapher. He was a designer of architecture and of city plans as well. He designed the remaking of the Capitoline Hill overlooking the Forum. Well, it was Alberti who first said that the architect, because he provides so universally for our comfort and pleasure, is the first of all artists. And this also goes back to the notion that the first thing man did to differentiate himself from the beast was to build a hut. And there's a very fine book, very interesting book to read by Joseph Rickwert. That's R-Y-K-W-E-R-T. He also did a translation of this book that was published about 15 years ago. The title of it is On Adam's House in Paradise, which was presumably a wooden hut. And so you'll find all the way up to the last author that I'm going to mention this evening and whom I asked you to read a bit from. That's the Abbé Laugier. By the way, he was a Jesuit and then later became a secular priest, and that's how he became an abbé. In any case, he wrote a good 300 years after Alberti, and his book, also by a man who is not an architect, then is sort of the at the end of our period. Not that this is yet at the beginning of our period. All right, so very, very important figure, Alberti. He advised his old school chum, who was by now Pope Nicholas V in the 1450s, on the redoing of the Vatican. And Alberti did other things. He figured out a system for dividing up a city using a compass by taking a high hill and using degrees of a circle, and so on and so forth. And he ended up becoming an architect. He designed a couple of churches and a palace or two, and he redesigned a facade for the Church of St. Francis in Rimini, which is an interesting topic in its own right, but there's not time to do it. Besides, it doesn't belong to the Baroque world at all. It's a Renaissance matter. After Alberti, we get a storm of architectural treatises. I'm going to give you just a few titles of them. I'm going to run through them very quickly, just so you'll get an idea of how much there is in all these different languages. So first of all, there was Filarete, who also did the doors to St. Peter's Basilica. And his work was in manuscript for quite a long time. He built an ideal city, but he was serious about it. And it was a city that is an octagon inscribed in a circle. This is because fortresses during the Renaissance were built in circular or octagonal or polygonal form. This was so that you could get a good aim at invaders. Then they brought in the cannon a little bit later on, and this made these sort of arched projections from the walls totally impractical because a cannon could blow right through them and you could get into the city very easily. But for a while there, the fortress was the ideal way to, the circle was the ideal way to build a fortified city. So Filaretti's treatise is extraordinarily interesting, but again, I'll just make you aware of the fact that it exists. Francesco Di Giorgio Martini, a little bit after Filaretti, wrote a book on, mostly on fortifications and fortified cities, but again, he has designs and drawings of a great number of buildings that would go in these cities. So this is also the beginning of what in the Renaissance is specific to it, the ideal city, or the imaginary city, or the city of the future. This is when it begins. We start talking about the city of the future now. And there's a reason for that. What Alberti did that nobody had done before him in his 10 books on architecture was to go out and actually measure and investigate Roman construction by looking at ruins. But his book doesn't tell you how to reconstruct a Roman city at all. It tells you how to build a contemporary Italian city or a contemporary European city. So Vitruvius tells you how things were built in the past. Alberti and these men tell you what to build for the future. And so this is a new perspective, really. And it is one that will dominate the Renaissance and will influence it considerably, as we'll see. Okay. One other thing I was going to mention about Alberti, but I'll take it up again. A very strange book. The translation here is rather amusing. It's the Struggle of Love of Polyphilus, We're not absolutely sure who the author was. There have been several scholarly guesses. It's a strange allegorical book that is filled with images of imaginary buildings and cities. And this book was itself very popular in many ways. It's a very strange book, an intriguing one. But in some ways, it too falls into this category because the illustrations in it inspired a great number of city designers and architects subsequently. Now we move into the 16th century. That book was published in the very next to last year of the 15th century. You know, of course, that 1500 is the last year of the 15th century. Fra Giovanni Giocondo da Verona, we saw him before, but I put him back here in sequence so you'd see how these things go. He translated Vitruvius. Diego de Sagredo, so this is Toledo in 1526. Medidas del Romano. And so this is one of the earliest of the Spanish manuals of architecture, and it is about Roman architecture, that is, contemporary architecture based on Roman models. Dürer, the great Renaissance German painter and designer, published a book on fortification of etliche Unterricht zu Befestigung der Stadt, Schloss und Flecken. So, how to fortify towns, castles, and landscapes, generally. And then the Vitruvius Teutsch. So there were a considerable number of German treatises on architecture influenced by the Italians. And then an extremely important name, Sebastiano Serlio, who died before he published his work on architecture, but it dates from the 1450s. Serlio not only had designs of buildings in his book, and by the way, all these books, Alberti's book had no illustrations. No illustrations. It was not addressed particularly to architects. It was addressed to powerful laymen. And this is an important point because it will lead into the character of the Baroque city, as we'll see in a bit. Well, Serlio not only published an important book on architecture, but he published an important book on theater design and stage sets. And this will also lead us into an important aspect of the Baroque city, because the Baroque city has its seeds now very much in Renaissance architectural theory and mid-16th century architectural practice. Of course, some people push the Baroque and art all the way back to the mid-16th century anyway. Hans Blum, von den fünf Säulen, on the five columns, and this is the whole question of architectural ornament, decoration, so that the Greco-Roman column, the classical orders, as they were called, the Doric, the Ionic, the Corinthian orders, all of these then were, you might say, not just classic, but sort of categorical aspects of dignified buildings. And we still continue that today, so that it used to be that if a building was dignified, like a courthouse, it had classical columns and it had perhaps a classical roof line and all of this. Other important buildings are, of course, churches, because during the Baroque and the Renaissance, we begin to see churches that are built to look like Roman temples or Greek temples, or they use the classical orders. And, of course, for us, it used to be banks. That's an important building. It has to look very dignified, so it's got classical columns. Pietro Cataneo, his four books on architecture from Venice, mid-century again. And here is Daniele Barbaro, the 10 books on architecture of Vitruvius. And then we get the French in the picture. Jacques-André du Cerceau, his Livre d'Architecture, and Le Premier Volume des Plus Excellents Bâtiments de France, the first volume of two volumes in the greatest buildings of France. And so already here we begin to see that this humanistic interest in architecture. Now, remember, again, these are not particularly manuals for contractors and builders. This is architecture as art and as idea. This is architecture and the architect as a sort of second god, the creator of a second world. The architect says, let there be a city. And there is a city. So, all the way back to Alberti, then, is this notion, one that ties in very nicely with the medieval term for God as the architect of the universe, because an architetto is simply somebody who builds the first roof, right? And heaven, the heavens are the first roof. Archos in Greek, and tectus in, or tectum, tectus tectum in Latin. Okay. Philibert de Lorme. Now, notice this one. New inventions for building well and at low cost. We start to get more practical treatises at this point, but also he wrote a first volume on the theory of architecture himself. Some of these books, by the way, are sort of midway between practical and theoretical. And in fact, many of them were pattern books. So they had floor plans, they had elevations. You know what an elevation is. It's a drawing of a building as it looks from the front, head on, face on, in two dimensions from the sides and the rest of it. So the elevations, the plan is, of course, the floor plan of the building is seen from above, and so on. By the way, I suppose you know that Alberti wrote the first book on linear perspective, and he taught painters how to follow the invention of linear perspective in Florence, and of course that was another huge turning point in the history of art in the Renaissance, but also it's a very important turning point in the history of cities, because as we'll see, cities then also are designed according to perspectival plans. And this is particularly true of the Baroque city. Giacomo Barozzi da Vignola, another very important name during the century, along with Serlio. Not translated into English until 1896, interestingly enough, and in New York. And then there are early books on architecture in England. Actually, I've got one that belongs here but is out of order, by Henry Wotton from 1536 on architecture, influenced by Vitruvius, and the first book to introduce Vitruvian architecture, although a contemporary and collaborator with Ben Jonson, Inigo Jones, who also designed theater sets, that's how he was a collaborator with Jonson, and court entertainment, but also was the first important 17th century architect in England. And then later, John Shute published a book on architecture. As I say, he's a little bit this is a little bit out of order, but anyway, Andrea Palladio, the third big name, so Vignola, Serlio, Palladio, and he introduces a style based on classical architecture, but modifying it and modernizing it in a number of ways. And Palladian architecture then is the basis of much classical architecture in Europe all the way up through the 18th century. It was particularly popular in England, and particularly in the 18th century. Palladio also designed a theater, the Teatro Olimpico, and unfortunately, I have to make a little confession to you this evening if I seem a little bit out of sorts. I had a computer crash and lost my entire presentation with the exception of these slides. So I'll have to fumble around a little bit. Well, you know, these things happen. I have five computers, and the one I was working on was the one that decided to give up the ghost. C'est la vie. Anyway, Palladio also created the stage. It designed a very important theater in Vicenza, and it's called the Olympian Theater, because the Society of Olympians there commissioned it. He was a member. And there, they produced the first Greek tragedy translated into a modern language, the Oedipus Rex. This was in 1585. And the stage sets, you can still see the original stage sets if you go there. There are plenty of Palladian buildings in the city, because, as a matter of fact, Palladio, who built all over Italy, nevertheless, has a greater concentration of them there than anywhere else. But the stage sets are made out of solid wood, and they're permanent sets, and we'll talk about this later. Hans Vredeman de Vries, and this is, again, another book on Vitruvius. And then Daniel Speckle, again, you notice how the Germans tend to write architectural books that are about building fortresses. That's because Germany, among other things, is not a nation. It's a whole collection of little dukedoms and duchies, and each one of them has to defend himself. And so architects who know how to build fortresses are particularly in demand. When Leonardo da Vinci, by the way, applied for a job in Milan, he pointed out that he could play the lute. He was, as a matter of fact, a pretty good musician. That he could paint, he could design and execute festivals and celebrations, and he could build fortresses. And Michelangelo, by the way, built a fortress above Florence. It still stands today. So all these men could be, at the drop of a pen, they could be military architects. And then finally, we reach our course period, 1600 or so, with another Spaniard, Juan Bautista Villalpando. You say, wait a minute, commentaries on Ezekiel? What does that have to do with architecture? Ah, Solomon's Temple. Since Solomon's Temple is said to have had its dimensions revealed by God himself, Solomon's Temple must be the other great model besides the classical Greco-Roman temples. This must be the great model of architecture. And by the way, this has quite a life of its own. And Joseph Rickword has written a book about that too. It's the same book on Adam's House in Paradise, where he talks about the idea that somehow Solomon's temple was thought of as being related to the first hut that Adam and Eve must have built to keep themselves protected from inclemency and other varieties of enemy after they were chased from the Garden of Eden. Guess who made, apart from a number of other thinkers, one man who actually published a book on Solomon's Temple was none other than Sir Isaac Newton. He sort of wanted to be a theologian and a biblical scholar, but he had to settle for being a great physicist and mathematician. But he did write a book on Solomon's Temple. And again, it was the idea that this was a structure that was, you can see the connection, mathematically significant because of its proportions. So that's what Villalpando is all about. Wendel Dietelin. And here again, you see another book on the five orders. And now we're firmly in the 17th century. And we get with Scamozzi a very important theoretical work now that will influence the entire 17th century well into the 18th century. L'idea della architettura universale. So the idea of universal architecture. Translated into English as the ground rules of the art of building. So this is an entirely theoretical work. And Joseph Rutenbach the Elder, civil architecture. And you notice here, this is about actual construction, how to build various buildings, beginning with palaces. He wants to go where the money is. Pierre Lemuet. Pierre the Mute. Presumably he wasn't actually mute, but he has a book on building for all sorts of persons, and another one which is a treatise on the new buildings that were being constructed in France. Not the old ones, but the new ones. And there's Henry Wotton, whom I mentioned before, the elements of architecture, which is influenced by Vitruvius, but also Alberti, and is the earliest of the more theoretical books, although we saw that earlier one. Fra Lorenzo de San Nicolás, Arte y Uso de Arquitectura in Madrid, and I'm going to go a little faster now. Another book on the five orders, but now we're well into the mid-17th century, and here we have the parallel of the ancient and modern builders that will become such an important theme in French architecture at this point. There will be Claude Perrault, one of the designers of the facade of the Louvre, also, by the way, the author of, anybody know? Something totally unarchitectural. The French fairy tales. Cinderella. And so Perrault is a very important theorist in the history of French architecture. But even more important is François Blondel. Now, there are two Blondels. One in the 17th century, one in the 18th century. Blondel is important. This Cours d'Architecture is the first textbook. It is the beginning, under Louis XIV, of the Royal Academy of or Royal School of Architecture. And so with this book begins professional architecture. So Alberti and the others may have practiced architecture at one point or another, but there was not a professional school for training architects until the 1670s and 80s in France. Von Kunth, and again, it's another one of those five-column treatises, but notice the Scamozza is mentioned here, misspelled, but mentioned. And a Spaniard with the name of De Lobkowitz, with a curious title, Architectura Civil Recta y Obliqua. What is upright and oblique? Well, we're well within the Baroque period. And the oblique line now will become, and the curve will become more and more important. Classical Roman and Greek architecture is highly rectilinear. Everything's at 90 degrees. The Baroque starts picking up very fluid lines. And so, of course, the Gothic did as well. But during the Renaissance, the prestige went to imitating the ancients. Now in the Baroque, we begin to get what at first, in some cases, like the famous example of the little church at the intersection of four streets called the Quattro Fontane. There's a fountain on each corner of this intersection, and there's a little church there dedicated to St. Charles Borromeo. It was done by the mad architect, or at least he ended up mad at the end of his career, Borromini, a rival of Bernini, and you'll hear about Bernini next time. And Borromini made this church that looks like somebody took a huge torch to it and melted it. It's just very strange. Guarino Guarini, Charles Davillet, again, looking at Vignola, Andrea Pozzo, and notice rules and examples of perspective proper for painters and architects. By the way, perspectival drawing was very important, not for builders, not for the constructors of buildings, not for the workers, but for the clients. What the workers wanted was blueprints. And there's a peculiar way of representing buildings that's meant for the craftsmen who build the buildings. You get angled views of the building, but they're not perspectival. The lines are all equal. So you're looking down at the building at about a three-quarter perspective, and the line back here is at right angles. And it is the same length as this side over here. All the lines are equal. So that's the builder's perspective. The patron's perspective is different. I want to see what it will look like when I'm standing in front of it. And so architects had to master the art of linear perspective. As we'll see, that has another meaning as well. Nikolaus Goldmann and Leon Christoph Sturm. Again, civil architecture as opposed to military architecture. And then finally, the 18th century, Domenico De Rossi. And you begin to get treatises. And this is just a handful of some of the most prominent. There are hundreds of these things published from the 16th century on. Cordemois, Decker, princely architecture, Colin Campbell, Vitruvius Petrinicus, we saw that before, and a very important figure, Fischer von Erlach, who himself was fascinated by Solomon's temple and spent a lot of time ruminating over the proportions of Solomon's temple, but an important figure in his own right. James Gibbs. Now, this is interesting because Gibbs provided pattern books for builders. In other words, it's like a pattern book for a dressmaker. So you got different examples of facades and columns and all this, and you go through and you look at the pattern book and say, okay, I'll take a dozen of these and three or four of those, and I'll like one of these for the back porch, and I want this roof line, and so on. And also, you notice that representation has become increasingly important. This is one of the things you learned in architecture school. And remember, there is architecture school now. In the 18th century, Robert Morris and Brizeux. And notice again, the art of building country houses, estates, villas, but also he wrote a treatise on beauty. So architectural writing runs the gamut from the highly practical or the pattern book all the way up to aesthetics and philosophical concerns. Bibiena, another important provider of designs and patterns. Beaufranc, this is a textbook that was taught in the architectural schools. Blondel, Jean-François, not related to the earlier Blondel, and he then was the most important, he was the head of the school of architecture that he founded, and he published a very important four-volume work that was sort of canonical throughout the rest of the 18th century. Plus another one in six volumes. He was quite prolific. And then Marc-Antoine Laugier, who was a priest who wrote a little book on architecture and cities and gardening that was astonishingly popular and influential, despite the fact that he never built a building in his life. It's just a passion of his. But he also gives a kind of overview of architecture in the past, and he makes all kinds of recommendations based on his own observations. So he's more an architecture critic than an architecture theorist. Isaac Ware, and there's that word body again. William Chambers, who was especially important in the second half of the 18th century as a garden designer and landscape designer, and had a powerful influence not only on English gardening, but on continental gardens as well. And then finally, actually a bit outside our cutoff date, is Piranesi, who did a famous series of engravings of the ruins of Rome, Rome in the 18th century. And you can find those fairly easily. His book has been reprinted quite a few times. Okay, now that I've bored you enough with that, just to convince you that there is a great deal of activity going on, not only in architecture, but in thinking about architecture, let's turn to the two major cities that had the greatest impact on architecture in the Baroque period. Actually, it's about 5 to 7. It's probably time for a... Is it time for a break? No, we started at 7, didn't we? I'll go on a little bit and talk. Somehow I had the idea that we had all started at 6:30, but we didn't. We started at 7. You'd think I'd be in the habit by now. This about sums it up for Baroque architecture. Baroque architecture and Baroque cities say, I am a monument. Look at me. I am big. I am powerful. I represent power. By the way, this is not a Baroque drawing at all. It is by a contemporary architect who wrote a very interesting book called Learning from Las Vegas. And this illustration comes from Learning from Las Vegas. But I'm going to have to skip through a few things here. I wonder if anybody recognizes this city. It's Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And Washington, D.C. is an excellent example of a city that was based through and through on Baroque design. We have two elements here. One is the grid pattern, and the other is the diagonal, or the radiating street, the street that radiates out from a central point. What L'Enfant did at Washington was to combine two important elements. I won't call them innovations. They weren't Baroque innovations, but they became characteristic of the Baroque city. And that is the plaza with radiating streets coming out from it, on the one hand, and then the use of the grid. But just as classical architecture started to melt and break into oblique lines, so you had rectilinear and oblique architecture, so you get rectilinear and oblique city plans or street layouts. The Baroque period is the period of discovery of the street, almost, one could say, of the invention of the street. Now, what is meant by that? Well, let's see. Jefferson, by the way, who liked the grid plan, sketched out an idea for Washington that was something like this. But Major Charles L'Enfant, a Frenchman who was a friend of Washington, had seen all of these Baroque cities in Europe and had said Washington needed a much grander and more unusual design, one that was more suited to a democracy. Now, this is interesting, because if Washington was meant to be a capital for a democracy, with its overlay of radiating streets and diagonals over a grid, then we have to ask what the implications of that might have been. And the answer is quite simply that the Baroque city is a hierarchical city that is meant to express power, political power in particular, and that is designed then to symbolize that hierarchy. So it gives you a structure that is very aristocratic, very royal, and actually somewhat dictatorial. That is why, in the 20th century, what came to be known popularly as fascist architecture was based not merely on Roman imperial architecture, but also on Baroque architecture, the architecture of power. Well, how can Washington be an architecture of power? You recognize, of course, the Palladian elements, the classical elements, the Capitol is, of course, a building itself that was influenced by St. Peter's. More about that in a bit. But how could Washington represent a democracy in its street plan while the Baroque cities that preceded it represented monarchies and absolute monarchies at that? Well, we'll see. This is a model of ancient Pergamon in Asia Minor, a Greek city, of course. And you'll notice that the ancient Greek city had a layout that was somewhat suited to the terrain in various ways. This would have been a burial place over here. You'll notice that there's something like a sort of square here and there. But compare that with London, influenced by the Baroque. This is Baroque London, and it was influenced by Italian practice. By the way, not yet by French practice, but by Italian practice. And here you see the diagonals that we saw in Washington. All right, so there's a grid here. Roughly, there are a few deviations. And over here is a radiating circular plan. But they are tied together by something very important, and that is an axis. Look at that straight axis. Now, do you happen to recall from a couple of the essays a man by the name of John Evelyn, who lived in the middle of the 17th century. And after the Great Fire in London in the 1760s, he visited Rome, and he was much struck by a street in Rome, the Via Pia, P-I-A. This was a street that was designed by Michelangelo in the first half of the 16th century. And it was a street that went straight from a piazza at the top of a hill where the papal residence was. The popes lived in the Quirinale Palace, which is up out of Rome to the north and away from the swamps and the lower areas. The Vatican, by the way, was in swampy territory, and they were very much worried about malaria. So the popes lived in the Quirinale Palace, and there is a piazza, or really a round sort of square, a round plaza, just beyond it. And Michelangelo designed a straight street that went all the way out to the Porta Pia, the gate that led outside Rome. And Evelyn saw that and was wowed by it. Now, the idea for this kind of street came from painting. It came from linear perspective. The idea that a person who stands here and sees out to infinity has a tremendous amount of power. And it was Louis XIV who claimed to be the monarch in Europe who could see farther and more extensively in his domains and even outside them than anybody else, even than the Holy Roman Emperor. So it's this notion of perspective and power. If you're standing at the center and you can see down these straight points of radiating ways, then you can see everything. This all goes, the Via Pia, I've got some pictures that I'll pull out later, and I hope you'll remember all this well enough, since they're out of order, unfortunately. They were in order up until about 5 o'clock this afternoon, though, I'll have you know. So, London was very much influenced by continental urban planning after the Great Fire in the 1660s, when it was rebuilt. By the way, Evelyn's plan, he had a plan for the rebuilding of London, but it wasn't followed. All right, so if we look at the typical classical arrangement, the most important buildings are in the highest spots, and they are the most prominent then. So we had this kind of ancient hierarchy. But I'm going to skip this because it's not too easy to see, but you can see, again, a radiating design here that is combined with intersecting streets. This is a city in Germany, one of the duchies, from the 18th century. The influence on this is pretty evident, I think. It's not Italian influence. It's French, from Versailles. But these wings, which are curved, unlike the rectilinear wings at Versailles, are influenced by the colonnade that Bernini designed for St. Peter's. And you notice the square in front. Now again, this is a kind of emblem of Baroque power. So the resident in this palace can see out and beyond all over the place and discover that at the Vatican's, the popes had a palace called the Belvedere, the beautiful view, the Belvedere, which, by the way, means that he had a vista over a good part of Rome, because there was a hill. The Vatican is on a hill, of course. There's a hill behind the St. Peter's, which is lower down. And from that, he had a view to the north and down to the Tiber and to the west and to the east. And that we'll see that later on as it develops architecturally. Now, I mentioned the theater. There were theaters of a sort in the Middle Ages, but they weren't permanent. They were on wagons. They were in courts, in palaces, in large rooms, but there were not any buildings, at least in modern Europe, dedicated exclusively to theatrical practice until the 16th century. And then they start springing up all over Europe. Of course, there are the Elizabethan theaters, but they date from the 1570s. I mentioned the Teatro Olimpico, but that wasn't the first by any means. What was particularly prominent was what I mentioned earlier, scenic design. And here are two of them. This one is actually from the Teatro Olimpico, and it is in a trompe-l'œil scenic perspective. So if you're sitting in the seats, by the way, the Teatro Olimpico looks like a Roman theater. It's got a curved, raked seating, goes up to the top, and you look down on a stage with a proscenium, but behind this proscenium, the stage projects beyond the proscenium. Behind the proscenium is where the actual stage set is. These stage sets were movable, but they were carved in three dimensions out of wood. The difference being that you see these buildings that seem to recede back to a gate. This is a reproduction of the Via Pia, as a matter of fact. It's the same linear perspective, except that this really is in three dimensions. The difference, however, is that, and you'll notice the way the lines here lead to the perspective effect, the distance from here to here is only about 15 feet. But it looks like several hundred feet to the spectator. There's a very clever, Borromini in the 17th century did a very clever tunnel in one of the Roman palaces out in the garden. And you're looking down this tunnel, and at the end you see a statue on a pedestal. And as you walked towards the statue starts to shrink. Until when you get to it, the statue is only about this high, and the pedestal is about this high. And the tunnel is, in fact, tapered as you go towards the end. So it's another one of these Baroque illusionistic effects. Here on the right, you see a stage set by another Italian architect who designed stage sets. By the way, this is a tragic scene, and this is a comic scene. How can you have a comic scene? Comic sets have a house on the left and a house on the right, a doorway, and then something in the middle down here. And all comedies then have a house on the left and a house on the right that people live in, and they come in and out of these doors. Tragedy, well, if you think of Oedipus Rex, he gets thrown out of the city, so you got to have a city gate here, and he has nowhere to go on either side. So the Via Pia gives rise then to these vast, long, and later broad pathways that become streets lined with trees, for example, in this instance. They're all over the place. They're in Paris. They're in the Cours Mirabeau in Aix-en-Provence. You see them in German cities. You see them in Italian cities. You see them in English cities. We take them for granted. This was new in Europe at the beginning of the Baroque period. It was new, and it was startling. There's a reason for that. Most of the Italian city-states in the Middle Ages were more or less run by the citizens. They were city republics. And space was scarce because you're a city-state and you have to defend yourself against not only marauders, but sometimes against the Holy Roman Emperor who taxed you or who claimed to have the right to tax you. And sometimes they would resist the armies of the Holy Roman Emperor. Well, as these cities during the Middle Ages usually had their most important source of economic activity in the center, in the marketplace. And there were gates in the walls on the outside, of course, and these gates then each had streets that led to the center of the city. They had to. The gates weren't there simply to control militarily. They were there because they charged a toll to merchants from outside the city who wanted to come in and trade and sell their wares in the marketplace, in the cities. So it could be agricultural products or it could be manufactured goods. They could come from other cities, but they were charged a toll or a tax to come into the city to do business. Now, there are two things about people who do business. They carry stuff with them. So the streets had to be wide enough for a cart. On the other hand, if you had a marketplace here and radiating streets like the spokes on a wheel, and you had invaders who managed to breach the walls, get inside the city, or break down the gates, you didn't want them to be able to move directly to the center of the city and take it over. So the streets in medieval cities tend to be crooked and twist and turn. In some cases, they're that way because the streets were sort of ad hoc creations. You know, they grew out gradually and they weren't planned at all. But in some cases, they were left that way deliberately. So as a result, you got your cart. On the one hand, you wanted the street to be of a certain width for the merchants. On the other hand, the citizens who have only a limited plot of land inside the walls want to have more space to live in. So they start encroaching on the streets. So they had to pass zoning laws. And these zoning laws say you cannot build out into the street more than this. Well, they started building second and third floors that arched over. Then, of course, the citizens started complaining that they were cutting out the sunlight. Well, this is the beginning, by the way, of zoning in Europe, at least in medieval Europe. By the time we get to the Renaissance, military defense and all this has changed. The whole structure has changed. We're no longer looking at small towns that are city republics. We're looking at larger cities that begin to take over a whole area. And we're looking at aristocratic families that take on absolute rule in cities like Florence, where the Medici then dominate, or the Sforzi in Milan, or you can go on all over Italy and find comparable things. Or in France, which is, of course, more than that, a nation, then you have an army that can protect in other ways. And so the medieval street plan now can start to change. And this idea of power and control, and by the way, though it is sometimes said that the plan of Baron Haussmann in the 19th century for Paris, the wide boulevards were meant to put down riots and revolutions, actually, this was a Baroque idea. It was there far back into the Renaissance, and it didn't have so much to do with military control as it did with a sense of power and perspective. So you get these all over the place. and we've become so accustomed to them now that we now find the old medieval cities to be quaint and charming and wish we lived there. You wouldn't have wanted to have lived there in the Middle Ages on your salary. I could tell you that. I wouldn't on my salary. By the way, towards the end of the 19th century, a Viennese architect published a very important book on city planning that was based on the city plans of the medieval and early Renaissance towns. His name was Camillo Sitte, S-I-T-T-E. And this was a book that had a considerable influence on all sorts of architectural planning in the 20th century. But I'm getting way ahead of us. All right, here is Paris. Notice Paris as the center of Paris is on the right. Notice it's not really a grid. Notice it's not really a radiating series of streets. Exactly. It's an overgrown medieval town. That's what it is. What's that on the left? Anybody know? The other dark spot there. Versailles. No? No, Versailles is much further out than that. Oh, no, on the contrary. It's a very ritzy neighborhood. It's the Bois de Boulogne. It's a forest. It's the Highland Park and University Park of Paris. So it's a forested area. Now look at it. It's very different in design. And that's very simply because the streets there were laid out in the 17th century. And there you see the principle of the radiating street. There's another reason for that. It was also a hunting forest historically. And this is a pattern that you would see, pattern of paths in royal hunting forest. So you had a place for the king and his retinue to repair these paths that would lead to a central point where there would be perhaps a small building, a lodge, or something of the sort. So this is not unusual, given that the Bois de Boulogne really was a forest. All right, let's take a break, and I'm going to work on getting my pictures in order. And what we'll do now is talk about the Vatican and the influence of the popes on city design, the influence of Rome then on Paris and Versailles, and from Versailles then we get all this subsequent influence. So let's take a bit of a breather, and we'll look at those two cities. By the way, the 1.5 cities are Rome and the Vatican, which is now a separate country, and Paris and Versailles, which is more or less on the outskirts of Paris now, but is at a fair distance from Paris. It was a village at the time Louis XIV started building there. Okay, so let's take a break.